You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to those out there in the lobby, too. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations.
I want to remind you that a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we had the conversations here in the gathering hall, and we talked about the things that we were thinking about in 3 years. But before that, we wrote down questions that we thought we needed answers to, that the board might be able to answer. We've prepared some answers for those that were answerable questions. And so we've got a bunch of pages here that you can take a look at. We'll have a conversation at the end of the service. If you want to grab your coffee and come back in here, we'll give you a copy of this and you can share it, or you can read the questions, and then if you have any further questions, you can ask them. At the board meeting, we decided that we would go back to Presbytery to clarify the issues around the property so that we know what our real options are. And after some interchanges that were less than fruitful and then a little bit fruitful, we've been contacted and we are invited to continue to engage around whether or not selling the building is an option rather than being forced to remain here. And that doesn't mean that we're going to sell. It means that we're going to be able to have the option. So we want to continue working on that without putting a lot of time into it, because the congregation has spent a lot of time working on things that then, you know, get nowhere. So we want to make sure that the time is being invested appropriately. And now I'm going to invite Babette to come up. Over the past week, I've received a considerable amount of mail in response to the publicity around the hearing being postponed indefinitely. And that has been primarily very positive. This is a letter that came, it's self-explanatory, but it came out of one of the West Hill Wants to Talks.
Good morning. This was written November 15th, just recently. Reverend Paul Hutchinson, to whom it's addressed, Reverend Paul Hutchinson, Chair and members of the Toronto Southeast Presbytery. I am writing you on behalf of the Shelburne Pastoral Charge of the United Church of Canada, a small pastoral charge located in southwest Nova Scotia. Earlier this year, after listening to and reading much of the coverage about Reverend Greta Vosper and the West Hill congregation she serves, and the position she and they find themselves in within our denomination, the session unanimously agreed to extend an invitation to Greta and members of her congregation to come and share with us their story. Our goal was to hear firsthand the journey they have been on and to provide a welcoming space for people of differing beliefs and understandings to engage in a respectful conversation on the important issues of their journey, has placed before the church. Much to our delight, when we informed the South Shore Presbytery of our plan, it was received with graciousness and financial support. Over the summer months, the event was advertised throughout South Shore Presbytery and through the Maritime Conference weekly announcements. Still, we had no idea how many people would attend this event or how far they might drive to hear former members of the West Hill United, who now live in Nova Scotia, speak. When Monday, September 24, arrived, I stood before the gathered crowd to welcome them to the afternoon session of the two-part program. There were 59 people sitting in the pews. The registration sheet indicated there was a small group who had traveled from Halifax Presbytery, another small group had traveled from the Valley Presbytery, and that 13 of the 19 pastoral charges in this presbytery were represented. There was also a good representation from this pastoral charge, and several community members who would describe themselves as agnostic or atheist. In the afternoon session, Greta explained her personal journey within the United Church and how everything she believes now is shaped by the education and opportunities for deep thinking the Church has provided her. Throughout her presentation, she gave example after example of the connection between the two. She and the former members helped us to understand the journey West Hill has been on and how their theology has shifted in response to their own deep thinking on questions of doctrine, belief, and reading the Bible as story myth, not as the literal word of God. Following the presentation, a question period ensued where people of every belief system put before Greta and the former members of West Hill thoughtful, challenging questions. One participant asked why Greta insists on using the word atheist and explained how hard it is for many people to explain this choice to people inside and outside the church. Another asked, what is the difference between where Greta and West Hill are theologically and the secular humanist movement in the United States? Another was deeply concerned about how Greta defined God and struggled with the idea of God other than an interventionist being presence, deeply engaged in our lives and world. Another wanted to know how many have left West Hill as they have made this journey and whether it was worth that cost. Several others were deeply touched by the stories Greta told and spoke in support of the journey she and West Hill have been on. They asked more probing questions about the conversations that have taken place within West Hill as they have moved from being a church rooted in tradition and doctrine to a church that stresses how we live our lives is more important than what we believe. The evening session had about 50 participants, with 28 who had been in attendance in the afternoon and 22 who had not been in the afternoon session. The session was a dialogue entitled Exploring the Big Questions, with Greta and myself participating. Here we explored questions of doctrine, the place of the sacraments in the church, who Jesus is for the church, how to read scripture when we do not read it literally, and several other themes. Those in attendance said afterward that it was one of the best theological conversations with points of agreement and disagreement they had witnessed. The moderated question and answer session that followed was filled with rich questions. Then, a young man rose to speak. He told us who he was, where he had driven from, and then said, "Where in Nova Scotia is there a church that is like yours, Greta?" He went on to tell us that he was raised in the United Church in Nova Scotia and that he loved the church and all it had offered him growing up. Now he is in his early 40s, has moved back to Nova Scotia, and wants to be part of a church again, only he is an atheist, and he cannot find what feeds him spiritually in any of the churches here. His question brought the room to silence, and I observed several members of this pastoral charge nodding their head in agreement with him. These are members who have children this man's age or younger who want nothing to do with the church as they have known it. There is so much of what we say and pretend to believe that they just cannot adhere to. So they go elsewhere looking for something that will feed them spiritually because they are clear the church is not offering what they want, need. While it was already clear before this young man spoke that most in attendance at the evening session did not have any significant issues with the position Greta and West Hill hold in regard to the matters that were discussed, this young man helped them to see what she and her congregation offer to those who have moved beyond the historic creedal doctrines of the church that have been espoused by the church as essential to her self-understanding since the church fathers agreed upon them. This young man is one of that large cohort of former church members who believe that how we live our life is more important than what we believe. He believes that being part of a community that helps us live lives of purpose and meaning is more important than what we believe. He wants to be a part of a community that endorses and teaches the values of love, compassion, peace building, and justice making that are the core values of the church, but without the language of an interventionist God he does not believe in, and he is asking the church to hear his voice. Although it wasn't planned, this young man crystallized for many in attendance the purpose West Hill and Reverend Vosper are trying to welcome, embrace, and provide sacred space for within our United Church. At the session meeting held November 5th, the session had its first opportunity to debrief following the event with Greta and former members of West Hill. After a lively conversation, I was asked to convey to your presbytery and other bodies within the United Church the session's deep support for Reverend Greta Vosper, the West Hill United Congregation, and for the expression of ministry they are offering within the United Church of Canada. While individual session members do not agree with all of the changes Greta and the West Hill congregation have adopted, it was unanimously agreed that there is room in our diverse denomination for the broad spectrum of theological positions that are expressed, including the one embraced by Reverend Vosper and the West Hill congregation. We hope the wider church will listen to our voice as you continue in what we believe is an unnecessary and unprecedented disciplinary process that Reverend Greta and West Hill find themselves in. We also urge the church to consider developing study resources and a guide to empower congregations to have deep theological conversations about what we believe and why, and to aid us in having the kind of hard conversations about belief and doctrine that the West Hill congregation have already engaged in. Grace and peace, Reverend Joanne McFadden.
Very nice.
Scott will now lead us in what he has to say.
One of the more touching moments in that letter was that the minister of the church they were sitting in wrote and shared with everyone the young man's statement that he couldn't find a church that would bring him that, and I just thought that was very, had a lot of integrity for her just to pass that comment on, because it was a comment on her church. It also said her that she resonated with that and that, but I thought that's huge integrity, and to put that in print. I was thinking, in some of my reading I came across the word, and I'm doing reading in a large section of different types of theology. The word eternal kept coming up. Eternal. We want something eternal. And I was thinking, as we talk about being grounded in life, that's one thing that never changes, the fact that we are connected in life. That never changes. Life always has an impact on me. Weather, news, disease, food, everything has an impact on me. And I have an impact on life, always. That never changes. It will never be that I don't affect the life around me. What does change is our choice of how to do that. So when we keep choosing love, compassion, justice, and integrity, that's where we enter that eternal thing that never changes, and we make the change. We are the agents of change in that interconnected life. You're always going to affect it. It's how we affect it that always is the question. And we have to keep asking ourselves that question. What would love do now? What would justice call in this situation? You listen to the news. What would justice say here? So that's our impact always. And because I have a very good idea of how to do that, and I also have no idea how to do that, then you share your perspectives with me, you share your encouragement with me, and I grow in wisdom for having the impact that I want to have. I'm going to ask Babette to help me share a musical thought before we go into our sharing song. So just be with her in that. You don't have to sing it, but just the words about making that choice to have a loving impact.
The first reading is from John Calvin Coolidge, Jr., who was the 30th President of the United States. His biographer described him as he embodied the spirit and hopes of the middle class, could interpret their longings and express their opinions, that he did represent the genius of the average is the most convincing proof of his strength, and he wrote, "Nothing in this world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, press on, has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race." Calvin Coolidge offered us wisdom for the journey. And the second reading is from Adam M. Grant, who is a leading expert on how we can find motivation and meaning and live more generous and creative lives. "When our commitment is wavering, the best way to stay on track is to consider the progress we've already made. As we recognize what we've invested and attained, it seems like a waste to give up, and our confidence and commitment surge." Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
The theme for this week was but to prevail, provoked, of course, by the readings that others will be using in their churches from the Bible on this Sunday next year. And I wrestle with those each week if we don't have a theme that's happening, to try to provide some resources that can be used by those clergy. So, but to prevail is the theme, and you've heard some words around persistence that have come from contemporary writers like Grant and former older writers such as Calvin Coolidge. But this focused moment, which came out as a result of that, seems to have a far more personal tone to it. But it is about persistence, and it is about that the inevitability of getting through what you're going through, for good or for ill, whatever happens in the end. So I invite you to hold that idea in your mind as I share it with you. "Rare is the child who slides into this world buoyed by a rush of blood and salt water, whose mother didn't once cry out that it was too much, that she couldn't take the pain any longer, that someone needed to make it stop, that whomever was holding her hand needed to just shut up or leave the room. Rare is the child who nestles perfectly in the crook of exhausted, shaking arms, whose arrival didn't break o'er the crest of a waterfall of doubt and fear. Readiness not quite readied, possibilities unconsidered, and unspoken worries churned to froth upon the boulders of reality. We are born into amazement, into wonder, our lives yet to be trimmed, framed, and convoluted by the fears that rule the hearts of those who love us. Yet the greater truth to bear is that we are here at all, burst forth by a final, forceful refusal to succumb, our heads bobbing over the precipice of what might yet be. We are the brilliant story of life, lived, dreamed, dared, beautiful, persistent, rare. When my second child was being born, it was a home birth. It was before midwives were really legal yet in Ontario, but I decided to have him at home. And as often happens at the end of something, when you realize you didn't think during the middle of it, maybe I should be at the hospital, that you made the right choice. And that's the way it was. I had made the right choice. But during it, Hazel, my daughter, who was then 7, almost 8 years old, was there for the birth. She had helped me deliver her cousin about 6 months before that, very ably. I was more nervous than she was, probably because I knew what might happen. But anyway, during my delivery, she kept going like this to me, right? And I'm like, okay, that's nice. She's really, really supportive. It turned out I had said sometime earlier that every time I swore, she got a quarter. So she was going, yay, 25 cents. Anyway, she loved telling that story. And childbirth is one of those things that, you know, once we're pregnant, something's going to happen. Either a tragedy that's going to end early, or a tragedy that happens during birth, or we're going to end up with a child, right? There's something is going to happen. There's things that go on. The history of childbearing is not pretty. Women have died in incredible numbers over the course of history in childbirth. It wasn't unusual for young women to die giving birth to their 16th or 17th child, or maybe their first or second. In the United States, actually, mortality rates related to birth are going way up. They're very high compared to how we think the developed world should be in terms of maternal mortality. But that wasn't where I was going today. I was really going to the idea of prevailing. But that's a symbol of it, of our getting through what needs to be got through and finding the results at the end of it. Yet there are lots of times in our lives that that doesn't happen too. So I want to look at both the positive and the negative of that. Those places where persistence has prevailed, one of the people who is most quoted around that is Thomas Edison. Does anyone know that quote? He said, "I didn't fail. I just found 10,000 ways it didn't work." So he keeps going because he's a scientist. He's the first scientist who made a factory of ingenuity, a factory of researchers trying to find their way to solve some kind of problem instead of laboring alone in their own with their own little ideas. He had a whole factory of people who were doing that, coming up with these 10,000 ways to fail. Excuse me, and hopefully finding a way that he would be able to prevail. And Thomas Edison created some of the most amazing things that we use now, and probably dozens and dozens of things that, you know, fell into the basket, because who wants them? My father was a bit of an inventor. I spent most of his fortune on patents, which never got made, but he was the proud holder of a number of patents, which he enjoyed. But there are others. Henry Ford is another person who acknowledged persistence as the way of finding that next thing that would work. And I think he's the one who has the, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right. If you think you can, you're probably right. If you think you can't, you're probably right. So that's a way of speaking about persistence. So one of the things I wanted to share, a personal story that doesn't have anything to do with having children, was when I was at university. I had gone to university a year early because I wasn't thriving in high school. Read into that whatever you like. And when I got to university in my second year, I realized I started in physics because I wanted to be a nuclear physicist. But, of course, I didn't have the math for it because I'd left high school a year early, so I didn't have the calculus. So I failed physics, first time I'd ever failed a test in my entire life. And at the end of the year, it was clear I wasn't going to be able to continue in the sciences. So I went into the arts. But I had failed chemistry as well because I didn't know how to use my calculator. I didn't know how to do a cube root on my calculator. If I'd known that, I would have passed the exam. So I studied all summer and wrote the exam in September, and I was the only one out of all the people who failed who actually passed the exam in September. So that was good, but I still knew I was not going to be a nuclear physicist at this point. So I began studying religion, psychology, and English. But I wasn't thriving there either. I kind of couldn't get the sense of what the point of all this was. And I knew that if I went home for the summer after my second year, I would never come back. I just knew that I would leave because I just didn't have the zen of it. It didn't have any meaning for me. And so that summer, instead of doing that, I took three summer courses, one in May and June and two in July and August. And through that process, managed to get myself back because, you know, I didn't stop. So it was worth it to go back. It was worth it. I'd gone long enough that it seemed like it was a good idea to keep going. So I went back in September, went to school, took two more summer courses the next year. So did my whole third year in my second year in the summers and graduated that fall, which was the only way I was going to do it. I had to persist to get through. I had to find a creative way to manage that so that I would get through. And I actually pulled it off. It wasn't very impressive, I must tell you, but I did pull it off. And so when I got accepted to theological college a decade later, it was conditional because my marks from my BA were so pathetic that they had concerns about whether or not I would ever get through theological education at all. However, at the end of the first year, I cleaned up in the awards, and they lifted that condition on my continuing in school. So that's a personal story about persistence. The first one about the swearing was also a persistent story. But I wondered if you have any persistent stories. Is there any place that you've been in your life that you would like to share that you thought, you know, if you just did this, you might get through? I'll tell another one about that month that I was in the women's shelter in Winnipeg. It was a very difficult time. My child was not quite three, and we were in a women's shelter. And I had, you know, there was so much crashing in on me that I didn't know how I'd survive. I didn't know how I'd get through this challenge. And my sister said to me, make one decision a day and don't change your mind, which put this whole weight on that decision. I had to make sure that the decision was the right one. But that was so helpful because I made a decision every day and I didn't turn back on it. I didn't change my mind, which up until that point it was, okay, I'll do this. No, I can't do that. I'll do this. Okay. No, that's a great idea. Thank you. You know, like I couldn't make up my mind about anything, but centering myself in that got me through that month there and then got me home and got me into theological college and ended up getting me here. Look at that. So do you have any... Maybe those are a little too Anyway, do you have any persistent stories that you want to share? We shall share, you know, more birthing stories if you want to do that too. Maybe not. Okay, well, we don't have to do that. Yes, thank you, Babette. Yeah, sure. It wasn't really working a moment ago. Is it working now? Okay.
This is a story that is of persistence. It's not mine, but it's touched my daughter particularly, and through her, me. Her history teacher invited a Holocaust survivor to speak to the grade 12 history class in this past couple of weeks. And so Hetty, the woman who came to speak to them, is 89 years old and lived, was taken from school in their grade 11 year with her classmates, and taken to Auschwitz for 2 months in 1944. And her stories that were shared were ones that, as they were told to me through Cameron's broken heart and tears, were, of course, absolutely ones of perseverance in the face of so much evil and uncertainty. And that woman is able to continue to tell that story so that it will have the effect that it did on at least one of those students who heard the story, that she has the ability to continue to share it so that we can have our hearts broken and our minds troubled, and so that we walk with one another differently. I'm so grateful and in awe that she would be a human being who would have every right to see nothing but darkness in the world and to live her life with the right to really to live it that way, and doesn't and hasn't, and that she would take that time to retell such a painful story. It's perseverance and a gift and a blessing. So in this abundant blessing.
Thank you. No, someone else, John, wants it back there. If you could pass it to him, that'd be great.
I think we all share a story of persistence and unity here at West Hill, because I think the story of West Hill is a story of persistence, of the road bumps and the barriers and the little things that have gotten in the way, not the least of which has been recent stuff that's been happening here. And so I think we all have a piece of that story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And John's actually gone where I was going to get to. And in the interest of time, I'll skip a lot of the stuff that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to remind you about some of the things that had to, the persistence that had to bring about some of the liberties that we assume we have a right to, and that's women who vote, right? You know, that women in Quebec weren't given the provincial vote until 1940. Indigenous people weren't given the vote until 1960. And it's only people who persisted to raise those issues against all kinds of odds that they were able to have those rights extended to them. The number of people who were against same-sex marriage in the States just a few years ago was incredible. And now it's like, you know, considered, well, hello, like the people who say it's not okay are considered, you know, right-wing fundamentalists rather than the norm, right? So people, we have persisted and so changed perspectives. I wanted to bring to raise José Blanchet. Does anyone know who José Blanchet is? She's a journalist in Quebec, and she made the news when she was on, I can't remember the name of the show, Tout le monde something. All the world listens. Thank you. All the world, right. In Quebec, and she, as a cancer patient, had written a book about her decision to end her chemotherapy. This was because there are places in our lives where we get to the point where we have to recognize, I can't go on anymore. Like, when do we make those decisions? And she was taking chemotherapy, had got to the point where she was so unwell, she was sure she was going to die as a result, And so she stopped her chemotherapy, and she did a lot of reading, and she found out a lot of stuff, and she went on the radio and said, I think chemotherapy is maybe good for maybe 2% of the people who take it. And everyone went, oh my gosh, like, what? And doctors' phones were ringing off the hook the next day with patients who were on chemo saying, you know, is this just a waste of my time and my energy? You know, am I going to die anyway? Like, what is the point? So there was quite a big conversation erupted in Quebec around that. And a study that was published subsequent to that noted that the costs of chemotherapy are already unaffordable in many ways, and that conversation needs to take place. Like, how do we justify chemotherapy if we know it might extend someone's life for 6 weeks or 2 months? But how do we not do that if that's the option, to extend somebody's life for 6 weeks to 2 months? Somebody whose presence with us is everything. So knowing when to say, I can't put you through that anymore for me. I can't see you suffer like this. And if you're choosing, I'm not going to stand in your way. If that's your choice to stop chemo or to end this or to, you know, stop that treatment, we give the people that we love the right to make that choice. We don't say to them, but remember Thomas Edison, you know, or remember Henry Ford, if you think you can, or you think, you know, we don't say that to people in that situation. And so there are lots of situations where that's the choice. And there's where I wanted to bring us, was to that place between what's worth our effort and our time and what is not. And I don't often bring into the perspectives time the conversation about West Hill. I don't need to throw this around anymore. The conversation about West Hill and the United Church, except that I think that we are at a place where we need to make a decision about our future and how we want it to look. And what we need to account what it is we have invested. And there, I think, is where our choices lie. So we'll gather those of you who are interested after the service to share the answers to the questions, the had answers that came from you a few weeks ago. But I think we need to tally up what it is we've done in some way, and not this morning, but what have we done, and what have we made happen, and what have been the costs of that, and how have we borne them, and what do we want to see in the future? And I think when we're tallying those costs, it can't be just about West Hill, because we don't operate just as ourselves. It's about the United Church of Canada. And because I see the United Church of Canada on the brink of the same thing that Joanne's congregation is going through. A rapid decline in numbers, congregations that are made up primarily of people who are over 80, who will not have no longevity left that will support the church for the next, you know, generation. I have no interest, many of them, to support the church for the next generation. And so are content to close and their properties become part of the United Church, who can then use that money for stimulating, you know, programs that they think are significant or important. And I don't know what they're going to do when the last lights are clicked out, what they'll do with the rest of that money. But when we're tallying what the church has done, I think we have to look far beyond the church. And this is the conversation that I take when I go and speak in Edmonton or Fredericton or Shelburne or in England. I talk about what the Liberal Church has offered into the world and into our country and into our communities. And I think that that's been a very, very important thing. Because the Liberal Church has brought a perspective on social justice here in Canada that's very different from what some Liberal churches do in other places. But generally in the UK and in the United States and here, particularly here, our focus has been on social justice, on identifying a moral stance and holding to it, regardless of the cost. And so we have been active in our communities, in our congregations, of course, but each individual that has been in the United Church of Canada that has focused on justice has gone out into their place where they live and work, and they have shared that conversation. It hasn't been pretty sometimes. We've lost friends. We've broken relationships when we've stood by the things that we think are important. You were telling me, Jane, just a few weeks ago about a conversation you had that you think has now really put some relationships in turmoil, because we stand for what we think is right. And in the midst of those conversations, in those communities, what has developed is this tempering energy, this tempering presence that has allowed us to not be swayed by fundamentalist perspectives and doctrinal readings of Scripture that demand that we split the human community down to a number of people who have rights and a whole bunch that don't. It has denied that voice a powerful presence in this country. And so, too, it has said, you know what, whether or not we believe that there's a God, that behavior is not okay. Because there's a whole libertarian view that says, well, if there's no morals, then anything goes, right? It's a relativist perspective. And it means, you know, if that's good for you, go ahead. But I don't have to act that way. And if that's good for you, fine. But I'm going to do this over here, and it's going to take care of me and my family and screw the rest of you. And the United Church has said to that, no, that's not okay either, right? So it's been this tempering presence in the middle of our social communities for 90 years. And I think that's important. And so as churches close across this country, in small communities and in large, I mean, we've closed at least 14 communities here in Scarborough since I began here, and I haven't closed one of them, thank you very much. But we've closed 14 communities in Scarborough, congregations, and there's a loss that takes place with that. And it's not just a place for people to go to church. It's a loss in terms of the voice in the community. It's a loss in the terms of the confidence in which we enter into those conversations. Because people who are in spaces like this, grappling with significant conversations, who are building relationships around putting on a bazaar, which doesn't seem like it has anything to do with social justice, but it has everything to do with social justice. Because it means that we are strengthening our own well-being, our own sense of self, our own understanding through the relationships that we've built, through their reflecting back to us that we are people of worth, that we have the courage to go out into our communities and talk about those things that need changing. And challenge, go and sit in our MP's office. Even when the first time you go and speak to him, he stands there and goes like this to you, right? Two fingers because of Audrey McLaughlin. That's the only, you know, that she taught people in the House not to point with the finger. But not to refuse to be silenced by that pointing until the person actually says, okay, come on in, let's have a conversation. We have the sense of ourselves, that strength of ourselves that allows us to do that boldly, to go out and make that change. And so when the United Church closes congregations, it's not just closing congregations. It's silencing a voice that has been so important, I think, in the creation of this country, that we should all be standing up and saying, what? This cannot be. We cannot let this happen. Because at society as we have known it, the social democracy that we have enjoyed, it would be at risk. So we have to care for the United Church in some way so that it continues to have that presence. Now, I'm not saying that I think the United Church is going in the right direction right now. I think it's concerned more about how many people it has in the pews right now, and I think that's a problem. But as we go into those conversations about our future, as we try to wrestle with what happens because our building is raining when it rains, and you know we're going to have to put little things out in the parking lot so no one slips on the ice when those little become skating rinks out there, whatever. When we have to really think about our future, we have to think about the future of the United Church as well. And we have to find ways that we can strengthen that, whether from within or whether from without. How can we take that such an important gift, an important legacy that the United Church has given this country, how can we carry it forward? What are the most important, most feasible, most, you know, incredible ways that we can do that work? How can we do that? Can we do it within the United Church? Can we hold them to that vision that they held for 90 years? Do we have to do it outside of the United Church? If so, how do we do that? And I think those are the things we have to talk about. It's not just about us. It's about the country we live in. It's about 38 years together because of the country we live in. It's about being able to have those difficult conversations with our neighbors and feeling it's okay to have it. It's okay to have that conversation. It's okay for you not to disagree with me. I still need to tell you that I think that that's inappropriate. I don't think we can survive a world that lives like that. It's about having 2 feet planted on the ground and persisting in what the United Church has offered this world, challenging though we sometimes think it may be. So I offer you that. Oh, but to prevail. Wouldn't it be lovely if at, you know, the end, you know, after coffee hour, we'd be able to look up and say, oh, it's all done. We can go home. It's not gonna be easy. But I think that as we're tallying up what we have done goes far beyond what West Hill has done. It goes to the history of this whole denomination and the shaping of a nation itself. It goes to what we have been and what it is we feel we must offer the future. Thank you. Gone a little over time. Thank you for your patience. I'm going to invite you to go and get coffee and come back in here if you want to have the conversation about the answered questions. And I want you to go out into a world that we have changed, that we have helped create, that we have put beauty into and rights and legislation, that we have crafted according to the work that we have done as we have found our way forward toward what is right. That work doesn't end. So I call you to go out into that world and be bold about who you are. Have those difficult conversations. Stand up for what you know is right. Have both feet on the ground and persist. And then feel that in this space, as we have our own conversations, that you can be honest here too. That you can speak about what it is you hope for and what it is you fear. And that from that, we can find a future that holds the hopes that generations have had and carries them into the future. Go in peace.
Listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.